My name is Ginny Nelson, and I'm from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I'm state coordinator of an organization called Bread for the World. How many of you have heard of Bread for the World? Do we have any members here? Any members? Great. As it was announced this morning, this session has changed a little bit of its form because I felt that after going to Sister Marie's sessions that there were an enormous amount of questions that people had that really needed to be addressed before she left tomorrow. And so this session is going to be a brief analysis of the new international economic order, centering mainly on the issues of trades and tariff, and also then opening up to questions, any questions you have to do with that, and also from anything from the prior sessions. I want to start this session because there might be some people who have not been here before. What I often do is do sessions on the systemic causes of hunger, trying to educate people a little bit more about the basic causes of hunger to show that it's more than just a problem of famines, wars, etc. But I'd like to start out by including you in this process, and I would like you to tell me what you know. So I'd like to begin by just writing down a few of the base, what you see as some of the basic causes of hunger.
Americans wanting products that they can't grow in their own country.
Okay, what should we call that? Relying on cash crops?
Yeah.
Imports?
Well, distribution.
Okay, distribution, that's a good one.
Religion is a cause of hunger.
Religion?
Yes.
Well, that's interesting.
I've noticed it in India.
Okay. Cash cropping abroad, that fits into what you're saying.
Unfair trade policies.
Okay. Unfair trade, we'll put trade policies. Keep going. Culture and tradition.
I wonder if that's not the same as religion. I don't know how compact you want to bring that. But I think that's what this gentleman would have had in mind too.
Okay, anything else? How about some of the first things that come to your mind when you think about hunger?
Greed.
That sounds like a good one, and I have a C here. I'll just make it into a G. Greed. I'm going to underline greed.
Population.
Population. Unemployment. And you've dealt with that quite a bit. Unemployment. How about war?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been hungry.
Famine?
Soil impoverishment, what do you call it?
Soil erosion?
Yeah, that's one part of it.
Weather conditions?
Control of the produce.
Okay. Why don't you say a little bit more about that?
Control of what we produce.
You mean, is what I hear you saying?
I suppose that's
control, like the oligarchy, like having a small percentage of the population controlling large quantities of lands or products.
Okay.
Maybe I'll put multinationals for that.
Okay. All right.
Is it centralization? Rather than, it's not just multinationals, but when you think of these huge farm corporations buying up a small farmer now, they may not be multinational.
Okay, we'll just
say. We're saying the same thing.
Right. One more.
How about lack of education as far as growing crops?
How about inappropriate technology? Is that kind of what you're saying? Mm-hmm. Okay, why don't we stop there? We've got quite a few. Okay, we have distribution or maldistribution, religion, cash cropping, trade policies. I'm going to write tariffs in there. That would be part of it, but it's a big part of it. Greed, population, unemployment, war, famine, soil erosion, what's that? Drought, multinationals, and inappropriate technology. I'd like to start by reading a story. And this story is something that is a true story that happened in a town in Bolivia. And for those of you who know me, I have a hard time with pronunciation, so would you say it Postai? Postustai?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Postustai? Okay, this is a town in Bolivia. And Matt, pardon me? Potosi, okay, Potosi. Imagine yourself, if you have traveled at all, coming upon a village that looks very desolate. Have any of you ever been to a ghost town in the West? And try to imagine then yourself encountering this town. At first glance, it might seem that this town seems to be drawn out of its needs to be drawn out of its isolation and backwardness into the mainstream of modern economic development. It might seem that the town need an injection of foreign capital and technical know-how to pull it out of the state of underdevelopment. However, a closer look at, what did you say?
Potosi.
Okay, Potosi reveals to the traveler that it once was a part of the great Inca Empire and later a cornerstone of economic growth and political power in the Spanish Empire. The ruins of this once thriving center of development are still visible. Baroque church facades carved in stone show eroded but discernible images of splendor and abundance. In the 1600s, in the heyday of Potosi, they say that even the horses were shod with silver. At the height of its boom, the town had a population equivalent to that of London and larger than that of European centers. Something really valuable in the 17th century was referred to commonly as being worth a Potosi. The entire economic and social life of the town was based on the wealth from a single commodity, silver. This silver was mined by the native Indian population and shipped directly to Spain. The town's silvers financed in large measure the development of the Spanish Empire in the 17th century. Between 1503 and 1660, 185,000 kilograms of gold and between 16 million of silver arrived at the Spanish port. Silver shipped to Spain in little more than a century and a half exceeded three times the total European reserves. It must be remembered that these official figures are not complete. Okay. The wealth which was extracted from the rich hill in the town was shipped to the mother country rather than being accumulated in the area. Thus the development generated by the valuable mineral occurred in Europe rather than in Bolivia. When the silver ran out, the town's boom ended and the area was left to underdevelopment. The underdevelopment of the town then began with the abuse of its people and resources through the European colonial system. The Latin American economy was geared by the Europeans to meet their own needs, not those of the local people. The underdevelopment, which is characteristic of this ghost town today, has its root in the history of military conquests. Underdeveloped countries today are full of ghost towns, and nearly all were European colonies at one time. It must be said that the reason the Europeans ventured across the seas were largely trade and profit. They needed spices, gold, silver, and land, and markets in which to sell their processed goods. In this relentless quest, the Europeans disrupted the development and process which were going on in the societies they conquered. This is an important line. It was military force, not innate superiority, which enabled the invaders to subdue the native people and destroy the basic social units of entire peoples, families, culture, and religious institutions. The example of this town indicates how development in Europe generated undevelopment in the colonies. But this town is no exception in this. The pattern is repeated throughout history of military expansion into the third world. Okay, two important terms. Development and underdevelopment, then, are both integral parts of the same process. The development of some areas were accomplished at the expense of others. And the reason that I read this example was because it serves as a classic case of what is happening today. That was an example of colonialism, where it was an overt conquest of a country and occupation of another people. Now we are in a time where it's called neocolonialism, which means after the time of colonialism, and yet still in subtle but still very strong ways, the same thing is going on. I would like you now to read Amos 2, 6 through 16. And could you say your name?
I'm Grace Forrest. Thus says the Lord. Do you start at verse 6?
Yes, perfect.
Thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Israel and for four, I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteousness for silver, and the needy for a pair of shoes. They that trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth, and turn aside the way of the afflicted. A man and his father go into the same maiden, so that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar upon garments taken in pledge. And in the house of their God they drink the wine of those who have been fined. Yet I destroyed the Amorite before them, whose height was like the height of the cedars, and who was as strong as the oaks. I destroyed his fruit above and his roots beneath. Also I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, and led you 40 years in the wilderness to possess the land of the Amorite. And I raised up some of your sons for prophets, and some of your young men for Nazarites. Is it not indeed so, O people of Israel, says the Lord? But you made the Nazarites drink wine and commanded the prophets, saying, you shall not prophesy. Behold, I will press you down in your place as a cart full of sheaves presses down. Flight shall perish from the swift, and the strong shall not retain his strength, nor shall the mighty save his life. He who handles the bow shall not stand. He who is swift of foot shall not save himself. Nor shall he who rides the horse save his life. And he who is stout of heart among the mighty shall flee away as naked in that day, says the Lord.
I think one very interesting note in that scripture is that it says that the prophets will be told not to prophesy. And so I am proposing that the new international economic order is a type of prophecy. It's a type of, I guess it would be considered different than prophecy, but in saying that this is a new word to the people. And it's a word that's being put down. There's a copy here of the Declaration on the Establishment of the New International Economic Order, resolutions adopted by the General Assembly of the United Nations during the sixth special session in May 1974. We've seen here some of the basic causes of world hunger. I would propose today that there are some principles of justice. And when those principles are not fulfilled, then poverty, war, injustice occurs. And I'm theorizing or saying that these four principles are to be for everyone. The first one is sufficient life goods. The earth is the Lord's, and it's for the use of all, stewardship. We talked yesterday about how that food is not a commodity, but a right, that health care, that skills development, work. Work is a right to be able to work. Dignity or esteem. Each person is created in the image of God and in the likeness of God, so we are all precious. I don't want to be too redundant from your sessions, but I feel that if some people weren't here before, it would be good just to go through some basic. Participation, the right of individuals and peoples to shape their own destinies, political rights, not as some other people would deem those rights or determine what their destinies would be. And then the last, which is not down here, we didn't have room, but I'm going to put it, we don't have room for the other things, but it's solidarity. The corresponding duty to promote these rights with and for other people. These are just some of the basic goals of the new international economic order. Redistribution of wealth by changing the mechanisms that distribute wealth. Examples would be trade, monetary systems, and corporations. Development models and technology to be appropriate to the local conditions and to the value systems and cultural traditions of the third world countries. I'm going to go into this a little bit more in just a minute. Redistribution of power. Now we're starting to get, maybe some people might start to get hot under the collar about now. That's what. Third world sovereignty over their own resources. Decision-making power in international economic bodies, such as voting power within the International Monetary System and the World Bank. Collective self-reliance, redistribution of power within third world countries. And the last, which is not down here because there wasn't room, but I will read. Interdependence or solidarity. Interdependence being defined as global approaches to global problems and vertical based on inequality versus horizontal based on sovereignty and inequality. And we're proposing a horizontal basis for interdependence. And I'll go into that a little bit later. So now that I've kind of laid these out, I want to quickly go through them because I think that, as I said, I want to be true to my word so that we have time for discussion. I do want to preface this by saying that I feel that this is an incredibly frustrating experience, because to talk about even one aspect of this order, we could spend a day. And so I'm merely going to be laying out some of the basic principles and things that are coming from the third world. A cry that comes from the world is trade, not aid. Those who make the rules get the goods. I'd like you to say that with me, because it's something that I think is basic to the whole structure. Those who make the rules get the goods. Who has made the rules in the present international economic order?
He who's got the gold.
Pardon me?
The golden rule applies. He who's got the gold makes the rules.
Who's got the gold, did you say?
He who's got the gold makes the rules.
Right. Okay. Which in the present time has been the first world. An example of this in concrete terms would be that in the voting power of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, the voting power is controlled 20.3% by the United States, and Japan, Canada, India, France, and West Germany have another 29.49% of the world vote. This is supposed to profit 100 third world nations, whereas 50% of the voting power is being controlled by the first world. I'd like to start now and talk about trade and the new international economic order. The third world is asking for basic changes in the international trade laws. I'd like to talk about just a few problems that they encounter. One is vulnerability of third world markets, stemming from two basic causes having to do with diversification versus single export economies. I have a graph here that shows some of the countries and how it shows up how dependent they are on single export economies. One very strong example is Uganda. Over 75% of their export income comes from coffee alone. Another country that is very dependent on one product also is Bangladesh, which over 50% of its export economy and income is based on jute goods. And if anyone knows a little bit about what's happening with jute, is that now people are going more and more to synthetics, and so the bottom will fall out of that market very often. When you have a country that has an export and not diversification, two things happen. First of all, if there's any fluctuation in the international market, even of 1%, it has large repercussions on that country. The second thing that makes them very vulnerable is that if they only have one product that's producing most of their income, they're very much at the mercy of the buyers, in that sense that they don't have much negotiating power. So it's found that they often will be selling at much lower than the world price. One example would be Ghana, which its main export is cocoa beans. And Nestle's and Hershey's, which control basically all of the chocolate and cocoa manufactured goods being distributed, often will buy up to 50% below the world price. So that those two facts, you see that one thing that has to change if there's going to be any progress is that trade laws and the way that their exports are managed. Thus, they are caught in a spiral of debt because no certainty in the market. They have to take out loans to cover their basic food imports. And now this is a very important concept. The import margin and the export margin widens. Often countries, I tried to write it up here, but the pen wouldn't work. I'd like to just talk a little bit about the spiral of debt. We start at point one as in a game, and the country exports a product, a raw material for the most part. They have to import back the manufactured goods. However, the correlation between the raw product and the manufactured goods is not very equal. I have an example here. The unfavorable terms of trade. One tractor costs in 1960 165 bags of coffee. In 1969, it took 316 bags for that same one tractor. In 1977, it took 400 bags. Thus, what we're finding is that the people are caught in the spiral of debt. They have to continue to export larger and larger amounts of a single export product to buy the same amount of one product, manufactured product, that they were having to do 10 or 20 years before. Thus, what happens is they have to take out larger loans to pay for the imports. So the margin between the imports and the exports widen. And in regard to that, one of the proposals by the new international economic order is called indexation. And has any of you ever heard of that? I want to correlate it to our cost of living increases. Now, do most of you, when there's a cost of living increase, how many of you at your jobs get cost of living increases in pay? Okay. Is that saying that the rest of you don't?
It's not indexed, but there certainly is.
Okay, we're not talking about index state. Mm-hmm. We're just talking about, is that what happens?
In general.
Right, in general.
Do something about inflation.
Okay. Well, the basic idea behind this would be that there would be a correlation between, okay, I just want to say, indexation means establishing an automatic link between the price of manufactured goods and the price of raw materials. Thus, as the example here, I know a lot of you can't see it, but here is the graph of manufactured goods. If this would happen, prices on raw material would also correlate with that, so that it would take no more to buy a tractor as it did before. The prices would correlate. And the first world countries are quite against this, saying that it would defy the process of free trade. But as we see, we account for that in our country.
You're saying then that the inflation rate would have to be the same in all countries?
With those products, yes, there would be.
So which would mean the whole world would have to have roughly the same inflation rate?
Yeah, we would begin to talk more about, and I think this is what we're talking about, is more of an international order rather than individual national orders. Even though I will talk about this, it's been strongly stated that this cannot be instituted unless there's a national internal new internal national order as well. These words get kind of wild. Okay. I think I'm taking too much time. I want to just talk about a few other things that the third world are calling for, and then I think we'll ask for questions, because I know that that's what a lot of you came for. Another problem is that tariffs on manufactured goods have import duties on them that make it prohibitive for third world countries to manufacture goods. An example would be Ghana with cocoa beans. There is no duty, it's duty free for countries, for Ghana to import cocoa beans. However, in Japan, there's a 30% duty on processed cocoa powder. Thus, Ghana is discouraged from processing because they can't compete on the market. Having to do with this, what the third worlds are calling for and the new international economic order is calling for is for two things, one of being having to do with tariffs. What they're asking for is for preferred treatment, expansion of a system of preferences, which would mainly mean lowering tariffs. And This is a very hot issue right now, and one very common example, but having to do with two developed countries, would be Japan and the United States, having to do with high technology. However, this has to do more with countries that have not even gotten into being able to develop their own processes of manufacturing. Also, another idea would be collective self-reliance. And that would be that forming organizations such as LAFTA, the Latin American free trade association, where countries in would form collective bargaining agencies, or sometimes they're called cartels, so that they could have more bargaining power on the international market. Another problem is, we talked about the spiral of debt, is debt. And one of the responses to that would be, as I said before, producer associations. An example would be OPEC. Before OPEC, I know OPEC is a bad word for a lot of people, but before OPEC was formed, the money that was coming out of those countries was helping very little the countries that were producing the oil. Basically, it was going to the large oil companies. And so basically, what the third worlds are calling for is more rights over the money staying in the countries themselves, rather than that money leaving their economies. Another idea on the short-term relief would be debt relief. An example would be cancellation of official debt for at least the countries that are the most in debt. And there has been some things done on this. In 1977, Sweden and Canada, respectively, canceled a $200 million debt and a $254 million debt to 8 most severely hit countries. And in 1978, a group of about 7 countries canceled a debt that equaled $2 billion. I don't know if any of you ever saw the article in Time magazine about the debt bomb, but that would be an interesting article to read in relation to this. Another proposal would be debt relief for 42 seriously affected countries, and this would mean extending the time in which to repay loans and lowering interest rates on loans, and consolidation of commercial debts and a rescheduling of payments over 25 years. We find that in relationship of loans, when countries take loans out from commercial banks, they have much shorter time to pay back those loans, where in relationship to the World Bank. Okay. Another very important thing, which we talked about before, would be the third world processing its own raw materials. We saw through the example of the tractors and the bags of coffee that until the third world is able to compete on the international market and being able to process their manufactured goods, they have very little chance of getting out of this spiral of debt. I'd like to talk very, very shortly about multinationals, because this is a subject that I think is extremely complicated. But there's a few general principles that I think that help people understand why multinational companies are often viewed negatively in the third world. One of them is the net flow of capital. The amount of capital that is flowing out of the country rather than staying in the country. In 1973, the net flow back to the United States was $6.2 billion. And if that was in 1973, in 1983, it's probably much, much higher than that. And the multinational corporations control more and more of the private deposits in the countries. Thus, they... As some people say, it's often true that a multinational has much more control over a country than the government itself. In the case of Bolivia, 50% is controlled by multinationals. Thus, the multinationals are much more likely to give loans to corporations that are U.S. or first world based rather than local businesses. A few things that the new international economic order is calling for. Probably the most radical is the nationalization of multinationals. A classic case of that would be Chile. And there's a quote that I would like to read that struck me very strongly, because it was something that was coming out of my own country. This was written to the former Chilean president in 1970 by a United States ambassador. Not a nut or bolt will be allowed to reach Chile under Allende. Once Allende comes to power, we shall do all within our power to condemn Chile and the Chileans to the utmost deprivation and poverty, a policy designed for a long time to come to accelerate the hard features of a communist society in Chile.
That's quoting what?
That is quoting in 1970 the United States ambassador to Chile, to the former president. And that was carried out. We talked yesterday about it being an ideological issue. I take issue with that and saying it was basically an economic issue. Anaconda and Kennecott's combined net profit, even with depreciation allowances from Chile, totaled $211 billion. Whereas Chile represented only 17% of Anaconda's worldwide investment, it accounted for 80% of the company's worldwide net profits in 1979. Why is that? Wages, the money going out of the country rather than staying in the country. The new international economic order is not saying for us nationalization is one possible solution, but another is to have a code of conduct for multinationals, which I, in my pessimism, rather laugh under my breath at. But I'd just like to read a few of the threefold approach that the UN in this document takes. A broad, internationally agreed upon code of ethics conduct relating to rights and duties of host countries, home countries where multinationals are based, and the corporations themselves. Such a code would have to be backed by appropriate arbitration machinery, we know what that is, don't we, for resolving conflicts among the three groups. I think that would not only be what that machinery would be, something that could be enforced. I don't know if that would have to be guns. A firm and specific set of terms and conditions of entry so that the country would know beforehand, and operations laid down by each host government regulating the activities of the multinational corporations. Both the country involved and the corporation need a degree of certainty for the rational economic planning. Adequate publicity both of government regulations and of corporate performances. Regular evaluation of the relationship between host country and the multinational corporation enables the code of conduct to be kept up to date in the best interest of all parties involved. I'd like to stop there. I only talked about half of what I wanted to talk about. But I feel that it's very needed for us. I think that what we're saying is that the basis of what we're saying is if we are all one family, and if we are all one people, then it isn't right for 1% or a small percent of the population to have all of the goods and all of the rights and the rest not. And I am saying is that I believe that hunger is totally, and poverty are totally connected with power, and that powerlessness is the reason, the basis reason for poverty, in a real small nutshell.
The solutions, I think we can talk about them. I don't think this is something out here. We can talk about them right now. And I was just thinking, and when Sister Marie was talking, and I thought, well, now, who do we all know? We probably all know someone named E.F. Schumacher, have heard of him, you know, small is beautiful. Now, he, and there are hundreds of people who are working in the third world that are like him. He's just the name I'm happy to mention. But he brought out and brings out to us that the feasibility of third world nations using labor-intensive methods competing in quality to products that we have using their own natural resources. And an example with this would be something like, take Africa or something, and Tanzania's. They could deal, or Kenya, they could deal in leather goods. They could have, well, they have made a shoe factory, actually, but it went defunct because of they couldn't trade. We would not open our borders for their trade. But we could get the same quality shoe, and maybe even in better quality shoes from them, and pay possibly $10 rather than $50 from Spain or from Italy, where we have good trade relations. Now, this is a feasible thing that works, and it's all in existence. There's no problems with it. But it's our trade, what you were just saying, I think the GTT, the GATT, which is that? Gabbard. But anyway, our trade relations with each other and the way we deal with this is, of course, a major factor, and I think everyone can see that very readily. But the economists that are bringing out this notion that we have to open up our trade relations and open them scares the liver out of us, because we think we're going to go out of work. I mean, this is, you know, our people are not, but this isn't true. I think going back to this system, what is in existence? We can do things they can't do a lot better, let's do them, and they can do things we can do a lot better. It sounds simplistic, but it's real. I think it's just as real as what you do within your family. One person can make the wages better than the other can take care of the kids, whatever you have. It's simple. And this is, I think, the thing that's really boggles our mind, is that this is not complicated. What it means is, going back to the gospel, going back to these kinds of thinking, the notion of sharing what we can do with everyone else in the world. And that sounds like a dream, but it's not. To me, it's a very practical application of solving our problem. And I would like to see more sessions of this nature, maybe toning down a little, this is not criticism, but toning down the problem, which I think we are much more aware of, and bringing out the solution so that all of us out here can say, hey, let's brainstorm solutions rather than talk about the problem. Let's brainstorm solutions and then deal with it from that end. And it doesn't take a PhD to come out with these kinds of solutions. It takes people who just plain think in their own terms, in their own way, dealing from themselves, because they have knowledge that I think is in the solution, not the PhDs, the big economists, the big manufacturers, the multinational management. No, they don't have the solution, because they don't think in terms of human beings. But I think we people right in here can brainstorm solutions. We're not going to solve it all in one day, but that's where the start's going to come to really get the solutions.
Well, I just wanted to say one thing in response to that. Do you think that one of the things that is the most frightening, however, though, in talking about this, is as you open up the international trade to these kinds of things, such as labor-intensive projects, that it is in natural progression going to make the transfer of wealth, and that we are not going to be able to retain the current standard of living as we have it today, that there will have to be a transfer. That you said some of us can do some things better than other people, but some of the things that provide lots of jobs will be taken on the international market. And to me, I guess the point I'm trying to say is that when we talk about these things, I feel I have to realize that if I am open to a new international economic order, I have to be open to be giving up so that others might have.
Don't worry about it. You're there already. We are now in that process at this very moment of reordering, but it's being done along Western lines rather than including the third world. It's here now.
And I hear Gunnar, right? I'm saying that small is beautiful here too.
Yeah.
And we're better off if we do shed some of this fat. I wanted to address a question to Sister Marie, especially relating to last night's session. And it has to do with the same question of what the role of Christianity and the Christian church and the individual Christian is in trying to work for justice on the basis of the gospel and prophetic faith. It bears specifically on ideologies or competing economic theories. Last night, I think I went away hearing you say that socialism is a far better approach to world problems than capitalism. And I want to hear you further on this, but first I
can't resist sharing some of my feeling here. There's a book that you've probably run across, I forget the author, but it's called, I think, Christianity Without Ideology. And it suggests that Christianity is to exercise a critique on all ideologies because it should not buy into any one. It seems to me, I recall in that book, a critique of capitalism as not taking seriously enough human greed, socialism not taking enough seriously original sin. Now my question could be made more specific like this. Is the role of the Christian here, especially in our country, which is so culpable for so much of the evil in the world and economic injustice, is our role to work for revolution, to try to replace a basically capitalistic system with a socialistic system, or is it to try to exercise a critique over all economic theories and ideologies by trying to identify causes for injustice which are endemic to all systems which are human enterprises, and to work with the real stuff and possibilities in an existing country in the name of justice, which will involve compromise, I think. I would see in this country a movement within a basically capitalistic system which would incorporate more of the mechanisms of socialism, much like Johnson's Great Society experiment, which we now have abdicated, you know, in a wholesale flight from it. Okay, is your commendation to us adopting socialism in a rather pure form, or is it more nuanced than that?
It's much more nuanced than that. My basic thesis is that as people organize and name what they need and what they're doing, we should listen very carefully and respond to what their demand is. In national terms, it appears at the present time, from the choices that the new nations are making, that many poor nations are choosing, in their own interests, socialism. Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, Chile, I should take them in the order, historical order, beginning with Brazil. These countries did what we mandated them to do, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. They did it. In doing it, they looked at the need to develop a basic structure of life. And what I'm looking for is a copy of one of those statistics pages that I gave you yesterday. Does anyone, by any chance, have one with him or her?
Yeah, I think the small one.
Yeah, the small one. If you have it there, I just want to hold it in my hand.
That's my bookmark. I don't feel right.
Here's one. Now, most countries, as they, third world countries, are pragmatic. They're not ideological. Their people are hungry. They have usually come from a history of a very small group in control of power and resources, and a large group of poor. The whole of Latin America was in that condition in 1960. So much so that one of the Catholic documents that came out in 61 was called Mater et Magistra. And it was addressed to the Latin American continent, to the church. And it said to the church, you're too closely aligned with the wealth of the nations, and the poor are suffering as a result, and that's not Christian. And for the development of peoples, you've got to disassociate yourself from the powerful governments and associate yourself with the people. And that meant building the basic Christian communities, which is what the church moved to do, but not the whole church, about one third of it. Now, in building basic Christian communities, when people reflected on the conditions of their lives, they named the things they needed. More access to food, roads. The first thing they looked for was roads, channels into the city. There are no roads in Northeast Brazil. Between the villages, there simply are no roads. And going in a jeep through those areas and going over these little bridges over the rivers, it's absolutely death-threatening every time you do it. And I know from my own experience that that's true. So they wanted some basic safety. Now they said to themselves, how do you get it? being individuals in a village, they could do nothing. When they organized as a village, they felt they still could do nothing. When they organized with 29 villages, they became dangerous and they got opposed by the government. But in Brazil, in the course of about 1954, 58, I think it was, they did in fact get a government that was interested in what they had organized to do and what they were demanding. What they demanded was a literacy program, because immediately you need literacy to move into any kind of action. They demanded something that you've just mentioned, small factories that would produce farm equipment that they could use on small farm areas instead of on the big latifundias, because they were demanding a redistribution of land that they had worked for 20 to 30 years as families, some kind of access to that land. Now, if you listen to what I'm saying, you hear what they were asking for was social control of the land, communal control of the land they had worked, machinery to fit it, sharing of the machinery, not everybody having one, but sharing machinery, some basic right to the to what was on the land, and a national educational program that affected themselves. All right, those would, a national control of such a program, we would call socialist, controlling the means of production, social control of the means of production. All right, Chile saw that as a mode of development. And as soon as they established it with a powerful educational model, Freire's conscientization, our CIA joined with the military of Brazil, which was in the interest of the government that preceded that government, overthrew that government, exiled Freire, and re-established a capitalist separate mode of government with all the trade, international trade system that you just designed. That was 1964. Chile tried it, we moved in again. Nicaragua tried it, we are moving in right now. El Salvador is trying to try it. We just voted the day before yesterday to give enormous grants of money to the El Salvador government because of its advance in human rights. They have no advance in human rights. The redistribution of the land has not occurred there. All right, now, what I'm saying is, if a people of a country do what we did when we started, challenge the structure that controls their country, and recommend to their government, through their elected officials, that they want something different, that we let them do it. If it looks as if it's government control of the means of production, we still let them do it, even if we don't like it that way. It's third world countries, not our country, that needs to change its structure.
Is that true, though, Marie? Yeah. I was slanting my question in that direction, actually, more. What would you suggest for this country? We, after all, are responsible for much of this, and there it was, revolution or trade.
All right, now to come back to our country.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing, oftentimes in the questions we ask, the very thing that we reject. That is, staying on the theoretical level, shaping an ideology before we act, instead of responding to a need.
Mm-hmm.
I laid out the needs of the United States the other day is, we need health care that's not associated with employment, because we are going to have high unemployment. It's going to get higher and higher, and that's not bad. The reason we have high unemployment is we are all employed in industry for the most part. Now, I know those of us who teach are not, but we're turning teaching into an industry at the present time. And if any of you are looking at the structure of universities, hospitals, and school systems, you'll see that they're turning into a private industry. But in any event, we are losing our jobs because machines can do them better. But they are good machines. We invented them. It isn't better for us to work with our hands if a machine can do it better. It is better for third world people to work with their hands because they haven't got the machines. And they don't need the machines we have because they don't have the tool systems to repair them. They don't have the technology yet to repair them. They need the kinds of machines that they need and not the ones that we don't want. And that's what they have. They have the machines, our surplus products we sell to other countries, as you heard last night. And we sell them, and they have no use for them, because we would have to send our technicians with them. And the whole idea of using a machine is to tinker with it yourself so you can make it go and you do what it needs to be done. Now, so since we are going to have high unemployment temporarily, and I want to stress the temporariness, then we need medical care that isn't associated with it. Because we should get better from our illnesses with dignity and not at the favor of a hospital system who can choose whether to have an outpatient department, whether to have community clinics or not. We need clinics in cities, because if we walk in the city at the present time, there are poor people living in cities whose labor we don't need, especially in areas where new migrants from other countries are coming. We need education that is free, and we need social security for everyone, whether they have a job or not. Now, whatever we call that, we need it. We who have had jobs in the past are beginning to feel the same thing that our poor have been feeling for a long time, that it's easy to lose your job, and it threatens our dignity. But if the dignity is being threatened by other dignified things we've done, that is the invention of technology, just because we happen to be the people that are unemployed should not mean that our dignity should be immediately threatened by that. We should have a dignified way of staying healthy. The only way we can do that is affirm what many first world countries have, Canada, England, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, all these countries, and that is a national health program, which means we have to shift our thinking about health to health services for sick people, and the sicker, the better service, rather than health people for people who, health for people who can afford it. That means we have to retrain our doctors to work for the government. It also means we have to retrain ourselves to affirm high taxes. A lot of things we'd have to do. Now, if that's incipient socialism, all right, I don't care what we call it. It's not ideological, it's pragmatic. We need a health system, we need an educational system, and we need social security. So label it if you want to, but you don't have to. It's just that we have a human need, we have a way of handling it, we have a way, but what you've just pointed out, our trade and tariff system, and the other one that you were just beginning to touch on, our way of doing finance doesn't work. So that's where we should have our new creativity in developing a system of sophisticated exchange program. And I'll call it a money system, a finance system, banking, whatever you want to call it. So we address the problem. We let the third world countries that have developed a program do it. All right, now that's the end of that problem. But it generates a whole bunch of new problems, and those are ones we should begin. What yes, I was holding this in, could I just point one thing why I'm holding this in my hand? On the paper, I put Haiti right next to Cuba. I did it because Cuba and Haiti had exactly the same infant mortality rate and life expectancy in 1963 when I started doing this. And at that time, I had no idea what was going to happen to either Haiti or Cuba. But if you look at your list, you find that at the present time, that life expectancy in Haiti is 51 years, and life expectancy in Cuba is 72 years. That's exactly what it is in the United States. And infant mortality in Haiti is 130, that is 130 live births die before age one out of every 1,000. And in Haiti and Cuba, it's 25. Now, we allow Cubans who want to emigrate to our country, no problem, even when they send us out there sick people. We do not allow immigration from Haiti. We allow it from Cuba because we are ideologically compatible with the people who don't like Cuba that come here. They don't like the socialism of Cuba. But the Haitians are poor, hungry, and their land is controlled by our investment. No, I think he's next.
How are you saying we need social welfare? I guess we're locked into it.
You know what I'm saying we need? We need health care. I'm saying we need health care, education, and social security. I don't want to label it because you know when you're sick, you need health care. When you're trying to pay for your education, you need it. So we shouldn't conceptualize it in any form until we meditate on the fact that we need it and we can't afford it. Yeah. And that's what we need, those three things.
Okay. Now, how do we finance that? Who pays the bill?
These are the real questions.
Yes, that's the real question.
All right. So let's look at that. How are we, first of all, do we need it?
Yes.
Yes.
Do we really need it?
Yes. Right. Yes.
How much?
But we have to say that, because that makes it an Arthur D. Little question.
How much?
That is a problem that we have to solve. Now, if we look across the United States, we need it, but everyone in this room is relatively healthy. There are lots of other people in the United States who need it even more than we do. So we have to, in our saying, do we need it, we have to see this very large group that needs it.
And do we have to lose our dignity to get it?
That's right. And do the people that are going to be immediately vulnerable, if we pay for it out of public, out of our commonwealth, will be the staff.
What's the commonwealth?
All right. Could anybody help him out?
Fair distribution of our wealth through taxation.
Yeah. Our wealth is the resources we have. Our commonwealth are those is that of which we put into the pool.
Okay.
So the only commonwealth we have is the taxes.
What the U.S. government takes out of our pocket.
Right.
That's right.
We should pay much more.
Now, when we want lower taxes, why do we want lower taxes?
Greed.
Oh, no, don't give me an evaluative word. Just be practical.
Keep more
so
money.
You can pay for your health care and you can pay for these things.
What do you do with the money that you get?
Buy houses.
You buy houses.
Some
what else?
Buy houses.
Health care, education.
Health care, education. Insurance for your retirement, a bank account, what your children need.
Feed
and clothe your family. Isn't that what you spend it on?
Oh, sure.
Now, what proportion of your income goes for health care, education of yourself and your children, and your insurance policies and programs for retirement? About what percentage? Mine's different, so I have to rely on your information. About how much do you think of your own?
Would you be including that as part, like, if you're including it as the gross pay that you get, it's a percentage of that, but it's part of the benefit. I mean, we have it as part of the benefit of the job.
I just meant your gross pay.
20%.
Well, let's say it's 20%. Well, if everybody had that, that's 120% of your income you wouldn't need.
20%.
So we could pull that. Now, what we have, see, the reason we usually like a private system is we want to be sure we have the best system for our children. I'll say our children. But if we said we want the best system for everyone, then our children would get it, and we would also have it for others. So the problem is that the medical, once I did this with the staff of one of the largest hospitals, I mean the whole hospital system of New Zealand, in Auckland, and the doctors were very angry, but their wives were angrier. And what came out in the discussion was this. One woman passionately said, "Why, if we ran our hospital system that way, why, my husband's job would be just like being a common laborer." And so I said, "Well, what's the matter with that?" But the thing is, she had never thought of it before, that the common laborer is providing an essential element to our well-being. And if we didn't have any common laborers, we wouldn't have any system. And of course, people wouldn't have bothered coming to these talks if they weren't committed in some way, so you can talk that language. But we do have to think of that there is a status concern in our choice of professions. Now, we just began last night, when Paul asked me something at the very end, of beginning to meditate at least on getting joy of living out of the work that we do, mm-hmm. rather than just status. And if the jobs that needed to be done could be chosen by the people who like to do them, then the division of labor would be very different from what it is today.
We wouldn't have any stoop labor.
You wouldn't have?
Any stoop labor.
I'm not so sure. Well, see, the thing is, if machinery does that, we have no problem. See, the problem is that the stoop labor can be done better by machines than by people.
I thought you were against inventing all those machines.
I am. I have said clearly, I am in favor of high technology.
Okay.
And
good.
You heard me today, so you have to hear what I'm saying. I said it very, very strongly.
But aren't you talking about appropriate?
Technology is a good thing, and we need it to feed, clothe, and shelter ourselves. And we invented it from the best of our science and technology.
But I guess I'm confused then. In certain countries, you were saying, are you talking more than about appropriate technology in terms of, in some cases, it would be better to use labor-intensive...
If that's what the country organizes and wants is when it organizes itself against oppression. Mm-hmm. And that I keep saying that. We don't define for the other what the other needs. But neither do we ignore what they're saying. Like, you have just laid out an extremely sophisticated and important program on what the third world nations are saying. And the three things that you listed, when it came to the fourth floor for deliberation at the UN, Kissinger led the group that said, this is ridiculous. We would be fools to give this up. Why should we give up a system that repudiates? Why should we give special support to third world nations to foster the exchange of those industries that you recommended, that make the things that they could make with their hands? Well, the reason we should is because people want those things. That's the reason. So that some people would prefer the handmade things, especially carved things. But Kissinger was saying, in terms of international trade control, in the way we're doing it now, it's naive. He said, we will instead provide an alternate system. And the ultimate system is, when your system collapses, we'll help you with aid.
Hmm.
Well, in other words, you have to have a system, have it collapse. Collapse means people are dying, yet they're ill-fed. And you have to prove to us internationally that you're dying and you're ill-fed. And when you do that, we'll give you some aid.
Isn't that called patronization rather than participation?
But it's also a denial of what those countries have already done. It's to underdevelop them before we will give them
and make them dependent on our technology. So we send to Saudi Arabia a communication system that can't be run without our technicians, planes they can't fly. So we have to have Raytheon sell the product and then service it forever.
Right.
And so it is dependent then on our economy and our technology.
So then the answer to your question.
Well, and that's
a suitable economy, and it will grow, it will develop, but it begins. All over northeast Brazil, there were these little factories that were put up that have never been used. Like the Babassuna, many of you know that, is one of the main products there, and they squeeze the oil out of it, and then they send the nut. And the nuts go, and the oil goes to be processed in Switzerland, and then they buy back the products at a very high rate, when they could process them right there.
And both loans are contingent that you buy the products from the United States, so that can't happen.
Can we hear other questions just so they'd be out? I'd like to hear what questions people have. Maybe just.
But she has another one tonight.
Oh, is there another one that can
Oh, I need to say that this afternoon at 4 o'clock, I'm doing a session on, it's called Productive Responses to Hunger, and basically what's happening is if you would like to take back to your community some concrete things that you can be doing with your churches or community organizations